I've been here for about a week and a half, and more so last week, but some this week too. I think one of the things I've noticed is that there's several terms that keep coming up, and a lot of the discussions we've had, I think, trace their roots back to people having different underlying ideas about what these terms mean. So specifically, the examples I have in mind are cooperation and fitness, and after this talk, I might, after several this week actually, I might add cheating as well. And I think a lot of the sometimes heated discussions that we had last week really trace their roots back to people having different, either explicit or implicit, definitions in their head of what these things mean. And what I'm going to talk about today is another one of these problematic terms that I think sometimes causes people to talk past each other because they have different underlying ideas about what they mean. I should point out at the beginning here that for me, at least for the context of this talk, I'm not going to distinguish between individuality and what Dave Queller yesterday called organismality. For me, those, in this context at least, those are the same thing. I'm going to treat them as synonymous. So the first thing I always want to talk about when I talk about individuality is, does it matter? Because not everybody thinks it does. Jack Wilson says that we don't really need a definition of individuality, or in his terms, organismality, because most of the interesting biological questions don't require an explicit answer to this. And there's a degree to which I agree with Jack Wilson on this. I think there are lots of interesting biological questions that we can formulate, we can, you know, hypothesize about, test those hypotheses, without ever explicitly saying what we mean by an individual or an organism in that system. But where I differ with Wilson's assessment here is I also think there's an interesting class of questions, or class of interesting questions, for which it is important to think about what we mean by an individual. And to me, that's exactly the class of questions we're here to talk about this week. These, what my PhD advisor, Rick Michaud, calls evolutionary transitions in individuality, what Maynard Smith and Zath Mari called the major transitions in evolution, and what Buss called the evolution of individuality. And there's been a lot written about this topic, both by biologists and philosophers. And I think the sort of traditional approach to this question is to look at something that's unambiguously an individual, something like a vertebrate, or what Dave Queller yesterday called a paradigm individual or paradigm organism, and say, what is it about this that makes it an individual? Let's enumerate those traits, and that's what we're going to consider an individual, anything that has those traits. So, for example, vertebrates like me have functional integration. Lots of my parts are working together right now to give this talk. I'm physiologically autonomous from the other people in this room. I have homeostasis. I'm capable of maintaining non-equilibrium conditions with respect to my environment. I'm genetically homogeneous, I hope, or at least to a high degree, I'm genetically homogeneous. I'm genetically unique. I don't have a twin brother, so I'm very confident that that's true. I passed through a single cell bottleneck during development. Now, this is a side note, but a historian of biology recently pointed out to me that that's not the right reference for this, that Dawkins didn't actually talk about single cell bottlenecks until the 1989 second edition of The Selfish Gene. So if anybody actually knows what the original source for that term, at least in this context, is, I'd actually like to know it. I'm spatially bounded. There are areas that are clearly me and clearly not me. I'm contiguous. I can't be in two places at once. And I have a germ soma division of labor. Only a small subset of my cells are capable of reproduction. And if everything was a vertebrate, if everything had all these criteria in the same biological units, there wouldn't have been as much written about the question of what is an individual. But the fact is that most things are not vertebrates, and in most living things, these criteria don't coincide in the same biological units. If that doesn't make sense right now, I think it will as I go through this. And this is exactly why we have this proliferation of terminologies. To my mind, all these different terms basically mean biological units with some, but not all, of the criteria I showed on the previous slide. There's certainly more I haven't thought of. Now, more recently, there's been a few papers, a handful of papers, mostly by biologists, that have taken what I think of as a more explicitly evolutionary view of this question, and a view that's more in line with the major transitions framework of thinking of individuality as a derived trait rather than as a starting condition. That's as Leo Buss put it. So, as David Queller told us a good bit yesterday, his and Joan Strossman's view is that organisms are defined by near unanimous cooperation and very low levels of conflict among the parts. In a similar vein, Folse and Roughgarden think that the important criteria are low conflict, although I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in this case the emphasis is on low conflict that results from a single cell bottleneck during development. Interdependence of the parts as evidenced by a germ soma separation, and functional integration as evidence that the unit in question is capable of bearing adaptations, capable of adaptive change. Peter Godfrey Smith and later Ellen Clark take the view that organisms or individuals are whatever has heritable variation in fitness. And specifically, Peter thinks that this is important because it's exactly the things that have heritable variation in fitness that are capable of what he calls interesting evolutionary processes. This is the idea. These things are capable of the sort of sustained and iterative adaptive change that leads to complex adaptations, or at least is capable of leading to complex adaptations. I mentioned before that most things aren't vertebrates. In fact, that's a bit of an understatement. Almost nothing is a vertebrate. When you look at this is just the eukaryotic tree of life. I'm not even considering the other two domains here. Vertebrates are just one tiny part of one tiny branch in that phylogeny. And I'm going to explore a few of the others today. So this is one of the algae I study. And Pierre really kind of forbade me to give a vulvocene algae talk at this conference. He said that was well enough covered without my help. But I'm going to spend one slide on these. Volvox, like a lot of things, has a mixture of sexual and asexual life cycles. So under normal conditions, they just reproduce asexually as haploid spheroids. When they're exposed to a heat shock, though, they release this chemical sex inducer that causes the asexual colonies to produce male and female offspring. The males produce these multicellular sperm packets that swim to a female, enter the female, and fertilize all the eggs. Those fertilized eggs mature into zygotes or spores that then germinate meiotically on the return of good conditions. In all these figures I'm going to show, the dashed lines indicate meiosis. Everything else is mitosis. So like I said, there's a mixture of sexual and asexual life cycles here. And what we're going to find is that in any case where you have a mixture of sexual and asexual life cycles, the traditional criteria for individuality are actually split among different biological units. So in this case, what I mean is that if we think about genetic uniqueness and genetic homogeneity, the units here that are genetically unique and genetically homogeneous are going to be what I'll call the genets. These are the descendants of a given zygote. But you can have lots of spheroids make up a genet because they're reproducing clonally. Whereas the ramets or spheroids have most of the other properties. They're physiologically autonomous, functionally integrated. They have germ soma, division of labor, and so on. So Volvox is a chlorophyte green alga. The ulvophyte green algae represent a separate origin of multicellularity. This is sea lettuce. You can find, in fact, most of the things I'll be talking about, you can find out on the coast here. And ulva sea lettuce has three different multicellular stages in its life cycle. There's a sporophyte, a gametophyte, and these weird parthenosporophytes. So the sporophytes produce haploid zoospores through meiosis. The zoospores develop into haploid gametophytes, and the gametophytes produce haploid isogamous gametes. But these gametes can do three different things. They can either settle down and form another gametophyte asexually. They can do the traditional thing that gametes do, which is fuse into a zygote and develop into a sporophyte. Or they can start developing like a gametophyte, but then undergo this chromosome doubling during development and develop into what's called a parthenosporophyte that then produces more haploid zoospores through meiosis. So what this leads to is we've got these plants or thalli that are partially haploid and partially diploid. And what this tells us is that, at least in this case, even though these things develop from a single cell, it shows that a single cell bottleneck in this case is not enough to maintain genetic homogeneity or enforce genetic homogeneity. Similarly, Porphyra, this is nori. This is the stuff your sushi comes wrapped in. Specifically, the gametophyte of Porphyra is what your sushi comes wrapped in. Again, there's this mixture of sexual and asexual life cycles that brings up the ramet versus genet problem. But what's really weird, I should point out also that there's one of the differences here is that Porphyra has only one macroscopic multicellular stage. The sporophyte stage is microscopic and filamentous, so extremely different from the gametophyte stage. What's really weird about this life cycle is that, unlike in Volvox, where the meiosis produces three polar bodies and one living colony, in this case, all four of the products of meiosis from these conscious spores survive, and all four go into forming this gametophyte body. And you can see this really clearly in these pigment mutants. So here, these are, I think 9 is actually the best picture here. That's a 16-celled embryo of Porphyra. And you can see that there's four different zones, each one of which is descended from one of the four products of meiosis. So this is fundamentally different from what's happening in all the parthenospores, because in that case, you're starting with a haploid thing. It's tricky to give these talks because you have to avoid using words like organism and individual a lot. That's why I talk about biological units a lot, because it's so neutral. In the case of the ulva parthenosporophyte, you're starting with something haploid, and you're undergoing chromosome doubling that makes there be two different zones within this thallus. But there's only one set of alleles. There's just one copy of it or two copies of it. This is fundamentally different. Here, these different zones are actually genetically distinct. And so there's at least a potential there for conflict among the parts. And I don't know if that conflict is ever realized. I don't know if Porphyra has been studied well enough to say whether that kind of conflict is ever realized. But it's at least potentially there. And actually, not this species, but a close relative in the same genus, because of this process, forms thalli plants that are split right down the middle, male on one side, female on the other side. So this is a little bit more extreme example of this idea that a single cell bottleneck is not always sufficient to maintain genetic homogeneity. I don't think there's a whole lot I can say about Dictyostelium that hasn't already been said, but there's a couple of things I want to highlight here. One is that, again, we have this mixture of sexual and asexual reproduction. The other thing I want to point out, even though their sexual cycle is bizarre compared to what we're used to thinking about, the other thing I want to point out is that a lot of these things we typically think of as dichotomies. Things either have a germ soma division of labor or they don't. They're functionally integrated or they're not. But they're all really, I think, continua. And Owen can correct me about whether this actually happens in nature, but it's at least conceivable in a Dictyostelium slug that it could be anywhere from completely genetically homogeneous to very genetically heterogeneous. So this is a really good illustration of how something we usually talk about as a dichotomy is actually a continuum. This is my favorite example. This is a multicellular ciliate, Zoothamnium. They form these multicellular structures that have a form of cellular differentiation. They develop clonally. They look a lot like certain types of bryozoans, except that in this case, instead of each unit being an animal, each unit is just a single cell. And they're quite functionally integrated. They have this thing, this black thing here that's connecting all the cells is called a spasmonene, which I think is a great name, especially given what it does, because what it does is, aside from connecting all the cells, it makes it possible that when you touch one of these cells, when presumably a predator or something touches one of those cells, the whole structure contracts as one unit, presumably, you know, to get out of harm's way. There's again a mixture of sexual and asexual life cycles because these cells are capable of detaching, becoming microgametes, swimming to another colony and fusing with one of the cells there. This is the equivalent of a sexual process in ciliates, this process of conjugation. That fused cell will divide meiotically and then begin dividing mitotically. So we can have these, again, I hate to use this word, I'll call them colonies, but don't read anything into that. We have these colonies that can be genetically heterogeneous because they divide, they descend from genetically different cells. And I think this is more along the lines of what Rick Grossberg would call a chimera than any of the other examples we've seen before. But what's really cool about Zoothamnium, those are just to show how pretty they are, these things get up to about a millimeter, by the way, and live mostly in mangrove swamps. What's really cool about Zoothamnium is they have these ectosymbiotic bacteria growing on their surface. And this symbiosis is absolutely obligate. Zoothamnium can't live without these bacteria. If you cure a Zoothamnium culture of these bacteria, everybody dies. So it's a really intimate symbiosis. And not only are the cells, the eukaryotic cells within a Zoothamnium colony differentiated, these bacteria actually differentiate over the surface of the colony. So this is one species of bacteria. But depending on where they're growing on the colony, they're morphologically differentiated. They have different shapes, basically. I don't think anybody knows what the function of that is, if there is any function. But, you know, it's a particularly intimate kind of symbiosis here. And I think that it argues strongly in favor of recognizing what others have called the holobionts. So in this case, that would be the eukaryotic and prokaryotic portions, as having at least some degree of individuality. And what I didn't tell you about is that Zoothamnium is actually not unique among these examples in that both Ulva and Porphyra also have ectosymbiotic bacteria. We know a lot less about their function. I didn't mention, these are thought to function in metabolizing sulfur compounds. We don't know what the bacteria that are associated with Ulva and Porphyra do. But we do know that if you cure one of those cultures of the bacteria, they're no longer capable of developing as a differentiated multicellular organism. If you cure either Ulva or Porphyra of their bacteria, they form these amorphous, undifferentiated clumps of cells. I think of them as being sort of like a bacterial colony that you'd find on a petri dish. So if you think about this in a major transitions framework, this is really weird. Because remember, each of these, Ulva and Porphyra, each represent a separate origin of multicellularity. These are both descended from single-celled algae. They've both, to some degree at least, undergone a transition in individuality. But They've only done that as a holobiont. They've only undergone this transition if you're talking about the algae plus the bacteria. So again, I think this argues in favor of recognizing that holobionts have at least some degree of individuality. So I hope, skipped one slide there. Yeah. I hope I've convinced you that what David Queller called yesterday paradigm organisms, things like vertebrates in which all the criteria for individuality coincide in the same units, are really the exceptions. It's the rule in biology that these criteria are found in different biological units. I'm going to propose that all of these criteria are capable of varying more or less continuously. I'm open to people disagreeing with that and coming up with examples that aren't. But I think all of these things, even though we usually talk about them as dichotomies, can vary continuously. The porphyria example shows most dramatically that a single-cell bottleneck is not always enough to prevent genetic heterogeneity. And if you think that functional criteria are an important part of what makes something an individual or an organism, I think you have to recognize, at least in some cases, that holobionts have some degree of individuality. And finally, going back to these, what I think of as these newer synthetic views of Strassman and Queller, of Godfrey Smith and Ellen Clark, and the Folsom-Rough garden, I think these ideas all share the strength that they're constructed in a taxon-independent way. They're fundamentally different from the criteria that have come before, because instead of looking at something that's clearly an organism and trying to figure out what makes it an organism, I think that these authors have tried to approach this from a more first principles kind of standpoint to figure out what's truly important about being an organism. And the last thing I'm going to say is that I think if you're really interested in evolutionary transitions and individuality, which I assume most of us are, we wouldn't be here. To me, what that means is that you're starting with something that's clearly an individual. They're forming groups, either by coming together or by staying together. And over evolutionary time, those groups are evolving into something that we would also call an individual. So, regardless of how you think it happens, there's an increase in individuality over evolutionary time, whether it happens suddenly or whether it happens gradually, whether there's lots of intermediate steps or not. There's an increase in individuality of those groups. And to me, thinking about it in that context requires thinking that individuality is at least capable of coming in degrees, in intermediate degrees, rather than there being some line above which things are individuals and below which they're merely groups. Come to the Volvox conference. If you have questions about it, you can ask me or Eric Hanschen or David Smith, who are all here. And I want to quickly thank my co-authors who've been very patient in this paper that's been in prep since the dawn of time. My PhD advisor, Rick Michaud, and several other people that have given me feedback on this. Thank you. Brad?
So one of the things to point out is all the metagenomicists are now highlighting the fact that you and I are more bacteria than we are human. So something to consider, that we're not so much unlike these examples that you gave towards the end that have obligate bacteria with them. And something to think about going forward.
I agree with that. And in fact, there's another way in which we're more like these examples than we usually think about, which is that we don't usually talk about humans as having an alternation of generations, but we do. Just like these things, we have an alternation of haploid and diploid generations. So that, I would argue, is a continuum too. Everything from you know, animals where the diploid generation absolutely dominates, to something like ulva where they're almost spending the same amount of time in each of those states.
Yeah, and if you ever end up teaching botany or anything related to that,
exactly,
teaching alteration of generations that way makes a lot more sense to most people.
Yeah, even within land plants, there's huge variation.
Yeah, it's actually a continuum. If you look through, especially the bryophytes, is where you see the really good continuum of alteration of generations.
Yeah, I agree with that. These cases are just simpler to think about because it's usually one bacterial species.
Yeah. And then, so what about Acetabularia? I'm surprised you didn't bring that one up because that's single cell. But it's almost a, we call it almost a pseudo-multicellular because it has effectively tissues, so it has zones of its tissue that effectively act as tissues, even though it's not truly multicellular.
Time.
Yeah.
That's why I didn't bring it up. And why it's not in the paper that's associated with this. Acetabularia.
Acetabularia. It's a...
I pronounce it wrong, I guess.
It's an alga. It's a single cell that's basically macroscopic.
Single giant multinucleate cell, yeah. Right?
And it's centimeter size, so you can. It's about the same size as ulva.
Also, codium.
Yeah,
like that.
Right.
I'll ask a question as well. Is there any sense in which there's a hierarchy of cell? Is there a hierarchy within these entities? Is there any cell typically that you can identify which is either the cell that began it all or a pair of cells that began it all and which therefore have some control or privilege vis-a-vis the later cells?
The short answer is I don't know. The slightly longer answer is I have trouble conceiving of how you would identify that unless you have some sort of asymmetric division. Because, you know, if you start with one cell and it divides in two, well now, unless it's yeast, which is the parent and which is the offspring?
Right.
Am I getting close to answering your question?
Yes.
Like I said, the short answer is I don't know.
But are the initial divisions symmetric?
Not in all of these. I mean, in Volvox, certainly there's a round of asymmetric divisions. But that happens late in development. One of the ones I didn't talk about is the brown algae. This is again another independent origin of multicellularity. In the model organism for brown algae, there is an asymmetric division early in development that determines the rhizoid, whatever, the root-like structure and the plant-like structure. One of those products becomes the holdfast and one of them becomes the filament. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So the first division is symmetrical, right, in Volvox? It is. And so you're starting with one cell, it divides in two. Now, which of those cells is the parent and which is the offspring? Am I misunderstanding the question somehow?
No, but I think we're fishing for whether not all cells are equal in one of these
certainly
entities
not.
In some sense. So,
a lot of these things have something similar to a meristem.
Yeah.
At a given time, so in Zoothamnium, for example, these cells have stopped dividing. It's only going to be the terminal cells on each branch that are still dividing.
Right.
And that's true for a lot of the algae as well. A lot of the algae.
So I've got a comment and a question. The comment is simply that you asked the question about the single-celled bottleneck.
Yeah.
And to my knowledge, the first good discussion of it was Bonner, 1965, Size and Cycle.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
So it wouldn't have been Dawkins even if it had been in the first edition.
Right.
take a look.
Yeah, so then my question was, do you see any similarities between the study of the concept of organism and a species? And we, you know, obviously have social reasons why we as humans want to define what a species is, for example, conservation, endangered species and everything. From that point of view, every organism is endangered because it's going to die, probably, unless it's one of these, you know, corals or something that might live for a very long time, almost indefinitely. But so obviously, you know, you have the concept of, well, there's been a lot of arguments about species, what a species is, how important is a good, solid species definition for the theory of evolution. Of course, Darwin argued that it's something that's not easy to define, and people since then have gone through all this discussion. You have all these species concepts, and then you have the problem of speciation. How much is it allopatric versus sympatric? How much is recognition involved? And so, yeah, so what would you comment on that?
Well, I've actually explicitly made that comparison before in a paper with John Pepper, arguing for pluralism in terms of thinking about what's an individual. But I think it's the exact same rationale for why the question is important. Because just like you said, there's all this research on how speciation happens. Well, if you want to answer the question of how speciation happens, you better be clear on what is a species. Otherwise, you can't meaningfully frame the question, much less answer it.
So in the case of organism then, right, you're talking about the problem of evolutionary transitions, and then it is kind of important to have an organism concept.
Yes. That's exactly what I think. I don't think it requires us to be able to say X is an organism and X and Y is a group of organisms. But like I meant to say this at the beginning of the talk and tried to shove it in at the end. If you think of a transition as something where individuality increases, then you need to answer the question, well, what does that mean for individuality to increase over evolutionary time?
I wonder if you would make a distinction between tinkerisms and transitions.
So between what and transitions?
Tinkerisms. So,
I wouldn't, because I don't.
So some of those things are mushy. You can't really tell. So yeah, increase in individuality. Well, so some of the other things you can't really. It's a quantitative trait. You can't tell. It's analog. It's not digital.
Yeah.
And so.
It's a continuum.
It's a continuum, right? But an increase in individuality sort of sounds more like a transition. So a tinkerism was you make an adjustment, right? You tinker, right? That's a sort of a classic evolutionary. All right, tinkerism. Tinkerism, okay? Sorry.
All right. That actually doesn't clarify very much.
So. When you say transition, it's sort of like, oh, I'm going from A to B, or red to green, or it's a difference, as opposed to a quantum difference. I mean, that's what a transition sort of implies, whereas the analog thing is a gradual change.
I think I agree with you. I mean, I think that's part of what I'm talking about when I say that a lot of these things that we treat as dichotomies are actually continua. And, you know, I mean, the reason I study the vulvocene algae is because they have all these intermediate states that are, you know, from my point of view, have partial degrees of individuality and have varying degrees of individuality. But I think I agree with that.
As somebody tried to classify all the possible ways these meiosis, mitosis, and other mechanisms can combine, are there rules that constrain the combinations?
I have no idea. my guess is that if you did try to find rules and you waited 10 years, somebody would find an exception to your rules.
I actually have another question, and that is whether these entities are open to addition, or whether there is some rejection process. So if one of these cells wants to attach to a stalk like that...
Are you talking specifically about zooplankton or just in general?
Well, let's start with just this one and then some of the others, because in the whole notion of the origin of multicellularity, there's this idea of cells coming together and working together. But would there be some process where the cells that are already there check out potential entrants, and similar to the incompatibility studies that have already been discussed in previous lectures, so that in something like this, is there a coherence to it that represents the exclusion of cells that don't belong? Is there a belongness concept?
So, I mean, that's one of the criteria that I didn't mention at the beginning, is self, non-self recognition. That's another proposed criteria for individuality. In zooplankton, I don't really know. It's kind of hard for me to imagine that, you know, since these things do develop clonally from a single cell, I don't think they really have that problem. But one of these things actually does have that problem. Red algae, yeah. I don't know about Porphyra in particular. There are certain red algae, I hope I'm not stealing part of Rick's talk here, but there are certain red algae that... Okay, fine. then we're even. That start off growing as crustose.
Yes.
So they look like lichens on a rock. But if two of these, you know, this is...
Some of the corallines.
Yeah. And this is, you know, these things develop from a single cell, a single cell settles on a rock, starts growing. And at a certain point, they change from being crustose to being foliose. They start putting up a thallus. And if two cells settle close enough together on the same rock, the crustose parts will grow together and form a single thallus. That's actually a chimera in Rick's terminology. So clearly that's probably a breakdown of the self, non-self recognition when that happens, at least assuming that those two cells are genetically different. I don't know much more about it in any of these other cases, whether they have some kind of system for that and whether it's breakable or cheatable or whatever.
Very interesting. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, we have 5 minutes. I'll just comment on that. I think that the genetic basis of self non-self recognition and whether it's preferentially stronger or weaker with respect to kinship or genetic similarity at a particular locus, which might or might not be correlated to kinship, is really not known in most organisms, including encrusting red algae, foliose red algae, and so on and so forth. And so, to the extent that these really are self non-self recognition systems, much less kin recognition or kin discrimination mechanisms, in most organisms that exhibit some form of self non-self recognition, we don't really know how good they are and what they're for. But one thing we do know is in most cases, it's not just self that's compatible, it's some degree of non-self that's compatible. Mm-hmm. Usually heterospecific combinations are incompatible, and then varying degrees of relatedness. It seems that relatedness is correlated to the degree of compatibility in most of the systems we've looked at. But I've had my own work criticized by basically saying, well, those fusions that occur between genetically distinct individuals represent recognition errors rather than the operation of kin selection, allowing fusion between close relatives and not permitting it between more distant relatives. And I don't know how, you know, exactly to test that hypothesis. I have some ideas or to distinguish between those explanations.
Yeah, well, that brings up something that I want to mention briefly, which is that our ignorance about a lot of these things is vast. And I also want to point out, so for example, in zooplankton, for this species of zooplankton, I think, at least, there's about a half a dozen papers that have ever been published on this system. And almost all of them are about this this bacterial symbiosis. There's very little known about a lot of these things. And I also want to point out that I didn't pick these as pathological cases. I didn't pick these because they're weird. Each one of these things represents the best studied representative of its clade. All of these are model organisms to some, well, except for Zoothamnium, which just isn't that well studied. All these are model organisms to some degree or other. I think there was a question in the back.
Yeah, so on the problem of the species, I think the history of the literature on the levels of selection problem can teach us something here. So
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Oh, sorry. I'm saying on the subject of species and speciation, you seem to suggest that any theory of speciation is going to have to first start with a concept of what a species is, as though the species is somehow prior to speciation.
As though a species is?
Prior to speciation. So first we have to know what species is, and then we can talk about speciation. So I just wanted to draw an analogy with the levels of selection problem and the history of the literature on that. So we used to form the levels of selection question in a synchronic form. So we'd recognize that the biological world is hierarchically organized.
Right.
And then argue about which level of that hierarchy is really the level of selection.
Yeah.
Is it the gene? Is it the individual? Is it this? Is it that? And the major transitions research program has taught us that actually this isn't really a synchronic issue. It's something that changes over time. And that the biological hierarchy is itself something which is the product of evolution. And so there's an ongoing process that has given us that hierarchy, so that the level of one of those questions is not prior to the other. There's a sort of circularity to it, and I think we can probably, by analogy, learn a lesson from that when thinking about species. I don't think the concept of a species can be separated from the concept of the process of speciation. Each really defines the other, because it's an ongoing process which is changing through time. I just wonder what your reaction
with that.
To that
I
is.
I think if I said one comes before the other, then I was not being very careful. What I mean to say that is if speciation and how it happens is a question of interest to you, then it's important to think carefully about what you mean by a species, because just as in the major transitions framework, where I described, at least in my view, it's describing a process by which individuality increases, then if you want to say that you started with one species and it became two species over evolutionary time, it's fair to ask, what does that mean? Right? And really, I don't think you can frame the question without thinking about what that means.
Matt, I have a question. Could we imagine a unit of individuality? You said there are degrees. Could we measure this? We could call it the heron, for instance, or something. But
I like calling it the heron.
Even if it wasn't perfect, physics at least
has 3/5 of a heron.
Has advanced by measuring things and putting units on things. Even if it's not completely perfect, energy was, used in thermodynamics before people realized there was something called entropy.
Yeah,
measured the quality of energy. So
I don't want to answer that.
Okay, I didn't think so.
I'll tell you why I don't want to answer it, because somebody else has written a paper. Ellen Clark has written a paper in which she attempts to do just that using the price equation, and I'm not going to give away any more of her research that's not published yet, but keep an eye out for it if that's a question of interest to you.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Was just a question about what if you think about the bobtail squid, the Vibrio fischeri case, how would you compare it to this Zoothamnion case? I mean, because it seems that in this case it needs even more the bacteria than the Vibrio fischeri, which for the squid it's an adaptation, but it doesn't. It will reproduce without the bacteria, but it will not. I mean, it needs to have the bacteria to, like, hunt and so on. So would it be possible to say that this system, the Zootamium bacteria, is more an individual than the Vibrio, like the squid and its luminescent bacteria?
I think if you put it in those terms, I would say that, because I mean, these Zootamium colonies can't live without bacteria. So I mean, again, I think it's a continuum. You're describing a sort of a continuum of how intimate and how obligate the symbiosis is. But I think this is pretty extreme when one species just can't live without the other. And I'm sure it's not the only example.
Well, thanks very much. And so we'll reconvene, as you know, in half an hour.